Saturday afternoon, 26th May 1973. We already know that meditation, in its real sense, is communion. And that communion necessitates the absence of whatsoever disturbs communion. Now, this communion is not something static, nor is it a movement through space or time. It is a state of intensity of being, which is in perfect, vibrant poise. Now, when the yogi is in communion, he is entirely in tune with, in rhythm with, the totality and the concrete basic aspect of this totality is the earth itself and the body, the physical body. Now, this is where posture has its very great significance. You know, the usual simple posture, sitting cross-legged like this. Consider this position. The base of the spine touches earth. The spine is erect. We go up from the base of the spine to the brain. And that's where the body ends. But only the body ends there. This physical root of man, the brain, points upwards to the zenith. The zenith, which is infinity. And this, as you know, is the reverse of what holds good for a tree, where the root of the tree points towards the center of the earth. The roots of a tree are geotropic. Our roots, I cannot say heliotropic, because the sun is a definite object of the infinity above us, but shall I say akasha-tropic. Now, as you know, the earth has its rhythm. The rhythm of its daily rotation on its own axis, the rhythm of its revolution round the sun. The sun is the representative of life itself, of our spiritual being, of the perfect individuality within ourselves. That is what the sun represents. And the earth revolves round the sun and rotates on its own axis. Two fundamental rhythms expressing the coordination of the rhythm of our ordinary, everyday, worldly life and of our spiritual life. Look at it. It is convenient, it is helpful, shall I say, to regard it that way. So now, this posture of the body, where the base of the spine touches earth, Mooladhara, as it is called, touches earth, and Sahasrara, the thousand-petaled lotus, opens out to the zenith. Now, yoga has talked of various channels, nadis. And if you read your Upanishads, you will find what seem to be at first very curious statements of this sort. He who goes up the nadi, the hita, that's the term they use, which leads from the heart to the sagittal suture in the head and escapes by that route, reaches Brahman, never to return. And of course, scholars have thought that it means that when you're dying, you must concentrate your attention this way and escape out that way. And the statement as such perpetuates the great illusion of the permanent entity person who goes to the super-permanent, super-entity, Brahman, never to return. This language of the yoga is symbolic. It is also indicative of the necessary psychophysical conditions. Now, in order that the body may be in rhythm with the earth, the body must be as pure and clean as possible. You will find in the yamas and niyamas, the moralities and the religious observances, great emphasis laid upon shaucha, cleanliness of body and mind. As the sign of external cleanliness and the fact of external cleanliness, in countries like India, for instance, before meditation, the meditator takes a bath, completely cleanses the whole body. Also, he avoids food before the meditation for at least half an hour, preferably much more, in order that the bodily energies may be free of their preoccupation with the digestive processes. And therefore, the energies will help this uprising, this ascent of prana to Sahasrara, and departing from it into infinity. I'm talking as if it were spatial, but you must understand it is not spatial. It is mind space, akasha, which is concerned. Now, if this works in such a way that awareness moves through this particular channel, which is not a physically locatable thing, although several writers on yoga have talked as if this was a very exact anatomy. I know a book where the writer says, this particular nadi is exactly 2.5 inches to the left of the heart, and so on and so on. Well, 2.5 inches to the left of the heart is a somewhat vague measurement to start with anyway. Depends on the size of your heart. Now, if this ascent takes place in consciousness, then it is the conscious equivalent of the departure at death. It is the conscious equivalent of it. The body gets cold, and the top of the head is the only warm point. Saint Teresa, for instance, writes about this. And she writes in exactly the same terms, it's a most curious coincidence, exactly the same terms as you find in the books on yoga. There's a short paragraph, just 3 or 4 sentences, in her book, The Interior Castle, where she uses precisely the same language as the Upanishads. Now, the Upanishads call this the yoga sleep, the unmani stage, or the amanaska stage. They call it the yoga nidra also, the yoga sleep. But it is not sleep. It is an intensely awakened condition, with this being perfectly quiet. This, the body, the organism, is perfectly quiet. You can see, therefore, what has happened to awareness. There is no longer discriminative consciousness at work. There is pure awareness, total awareness. You may ask, why is there no discriminative consciousness at work? For the very simple reason that with the utter stillness of the organism, the whole psychophysical organism, the sense functions and the discursive mind activity is completely at rest. There is no more activity there. And because you are a yogi, you are wide awake. You have learned to be wide awake through mindfulness, samasati, the perfect mindfulness. This is why the training in samadhi is usually called training in concentration. But concentration has the drawback of implying a closing in instead of being inclusive. And also the drawback of regarding it as excluding this, that and the other. There is no exclusion taking place. There is a transformation of your awareness of this very world in which the body lives. That is what happens. So now, this entry through the stillness of the body and the complete pacification, the restfulness, the complete restfulness of the sense functions and the discursive mind enables the profound levels of the mind, the deepest levels, to come into full activity. Now, this is the state of perfect silence. But you will see that all that we call noise and the absence of noise, which we call silence, is integrated and subsumed in this transcendent silence. Come back to this question of the purity of the body. We talked of the external purity in terms of a bath or whatever it is. There is the internal purity of the functioning of the organism, of the organs of the body, the purity of the bloodstream. And this is a case of food and drink. How much food one takes, what food one takes, what one drinks, and so on. It is also a question of breathing. The air one breathes. You notice the tendency of yogis, if the circumstance allows them, to live at heights rather than at sea level. Moreover, there is also the question of the purity of every single cell of the body. Now this, of course, depends on food and drink and so forth, and also upon the growth of the sensitivity of the actual cells of the body. And in this process, the psychical life and the psychical states and conditions have a predominant influence, because they make for the supreme sensitivity that the cells of the body are capable of. When the psychical states are pure states, again you see the indispensability of the basis of morality. Morality in the profound, deep sense, not merely as a behavior pattern, but this real freedom from greed and violence and so forth. When that is there, the cells become truly purified. The physical basis, of course, has to be there in terms of food, drink, activity, sleep, and all the rest of it. See, nature is a miracle worker. She is absolutely wonderful. She's brought all this possibility into manifestation, and we have now to take over and take nature with us into the realm of realized transcendence. It's an extraordinary thing. So there is the purity of the cells, in that sense of the word. Not only the food, drink, air business, but also the utter purity of the psychical life, the psychical states. All this is implied. Now, in this posture, when the body is perfectly still, it is in complete rhythm with the earth. This is the need in yoga practice, where the meditation part is concerned, for perfect stillness. Now the earth, as you know, rotates and revolves. And we rotate and revolve with the earth. The rotation and revolution of the earth gives rise to phenomena day and night and the year and the seasons and all the rest of it, which we are conscious of discriminatively in separative terms, and therefore we react to the phenomena. If it's a wet day, we say, oh, how nasty it is. Is it? If it's a sunny day, we say, oh, how beautiful it is. But will you say the same thing under the burning tropical heat? I have heard powerful expletives from the people of India because of the merciless heat and shining of the sun. So you see, discriminatively, we are out of tune, out of rhythm with the earth, and therefore also out of rhythm with the sun. Bear in mind the symbolical significances of the sun, the spirit, just very roughly. Being out of rhythm with earth, with Mother Earth and Father Sun, honor thy father and mother that thy days in the land may be long. The land is your own psychophysical organism, and the father and mother are the sun and the earth. And if we are out of rhythm with this, then we are in the ill state. We are in dukkha. We are in the unhealthy state, the unwhole state. But if there is the complete stillness, and this very body moves with the earth without any criticisms, without any approvals, but is completely at one with Mother and Father, then the whole Trinity is present. Father, Mother, and oneself, the child, as the perfect unity. And in that silence, processes go on, great rhythms of life, right through the body as well as the psyche. And it is possible to enter those deep states of which just a very few words are to be found in the Upanishads or in the Buddhist texts. Just a sentence or two. In the Buddhist texts, as you know, the jhanas and the samapatis are merely retailed numbers 1 to 8 and then the cessation, which is number 9, like a table of contents. With just one or two, literally one or two words in that retailing, in that table of contents, which could give a clue. Now you see, all that is implied in the silence meditation when one enters seriously, is seriously attracted, drawn to Buddhist or Hindu teachings, one gets the longing to be at one with the infinite, to enter the void, to realize nirvana and all such things. These are desires, and they stem from frustration, from the longing to escape from sorrow, from pain, from difficulty and problems. We must bear that in mind. They are not yet the pure flame of aspiration. When there is something like real knowledge within one, you will find that that real knowledge comes with the purifying out of our being of the forces of greed and violence and the state of ignorance to a very considerable extent. Then, that which was just desire, which invariably is oriented to oneself, that disappears, and instead there is this pure flame of aspiration. When the Buddha, for instance, talks of summoning up energy, he also talks of the summoning up of desire, chanda. This is what, in its own context, Krishnamurti calls passion. This flame of aspiration is involved in it. It's a pure thing. It is the name for your own mind energy, the transcendent energy within you, rising up. It has its innings now. But you see the implications in terms of preparation and purification. If this is present, then one is no longer concerned with analyzing or docketing the different states which one recognizes after the meditation is over, and one perhaps pats oneself on the back saying, ah, that was a minor satori or a major satori. Perhaps some may meet Colonel Satori. No, do be very careful about this, because the truth is so lovely, so wonderful, so peace-giving. Now, I'm throwing out a carrot. See? It is so wonderful. All the rest is like murk besides the truth. There will be no analyzing, no docketing. There will only be being, the reality. Life itself unhindered. Life in all its beauty and marvel. This is the transcendent significance of Aphrodite, the goddess of love. The daughter of the sea foam, Let me not digress into that. One can speak a lot about that. One other point. You find this statement in all the religions, certainly in all the religions of the past, the great religions as we know them. This is the temple of the Most Holy. Know ye not, ye are the temple of the Most High, in the New Testament? In the Skanda and the Maitreya Upanishads, again unknown Upanishads because they are not included in so-called major Upanishads, it is stated outright, the body is the temple of Shiva. Shiva resides here at the Sahasrara region. Shakti, power, energy. The transcendent female resides at the base of the spine. And the yogi, through meditation, lifts up this transcendent female until she realizes union with her Lord Shiva. Notice again, the male is just a pure presence, but by mere presence affects, stimulates and affects the whole process of coming to fruition. Each one of us, man or woman, has both elements there. That sentence in the Bible, and Elohim said, let us make man in our own image. Male, female made he them, has colossal significances. So Shakti rises up, realizes union with her Lord. Now in that state, there is the perfect silence. This silence is reflected right in our earthly plane when man and wife have the perfect marital congress. On those rare occasions, whosoever has experienced it, you know that silence, that state of bliss. Not pleasure. You've gone right beyond pleasure, right beyond sensational excitement. It is bliss. You know its transcendence. You really know it. Because if a man or his wife are as atheistic, as hard-headed, hard-boiled, matter-of-fact people, they will acknowledge to each other, this is God. They will use the right words, but they won't know the full significance of it. You see, Father, Son, and Mother Nature have left nothing undone for us so that we can learn anything and everything through our psychophysical being. It is all there. The difference lies here, that what is experienced at the physical level is under the dominion of time, after all. And time spells decay. It spells memory and the burden and sorrow of memory, because it raises up longing for repetition. This is the trouble with the psychophysical existent. The desire for repetition. Because the psychophysical being does not know that our whole being, our transcendent reality, is perpetually creative and not procreative. And where creativeness is concerned, there is absolutely no repetition. God is not repetitious. It's new creation, everlastingly. So this is the temple of the Holy One, the temple of Shiva. And it is also indicated in the Upanishads that when this body, and in this instance the word body means the whole psychophysical being, is swept clean, then Shiva enters his whole being. This is man exercising lordship, dominion over the earth. This is earth. And all that there is in earth. This is the meaning of dominion, this lordship. No domination, but dominion, lordship. That which has been cared for, which has been loved, which has been brought to fulfillment and perfection. Now you see the immense significance of this. From us go forth influences every moment of our existence. And into us come influences and stimuli from outside. If this is purified, then this becomes the perfectly absorptive instrument of the Most High. And because of its intrinsic internal purity, it is able to transform the poison of the world in its own being and send forth influences which are only beneficence. One of the real meanings of the symbolic presentation of Shiva and Vishnu, both of them are presented in the same way. Drinking the poisoned cup of the world's evil and sorrow to its dregs and transforming it in their own being. That is the task of the yogi. That fulfills itself naturally through meditation. Now for us, just bear in mind the purity, the stillness, and letting life do the needful through this pure and still being. And you know that the body in this posture, in a general way, is the shape given to the Hindu temple. You look at your Hindu temples, they are this shape. Broad base, square or circular sometimes, and gradually working up like that. Dr. Stella Kramrisch, one of the great researchers on this, she has produced a marvelous volume about it. She points that out too. And the breath is also the carrier of prana, of life. If the breath rhythm becomes serene and perfectly in harmony with the earth rhythm, then this rhythm of pranic activity links up the whole psychophysical organism with the life rhythm that extends throughout space, throughout akasha, which means it includes the sun, the try and be aware of that inclusive wholeness. The sun, the earth, everything in it, on it, and your own organism in stillness and poise. And try and be aware of earth or sun as just earth or sun, free of the limitation of space and distance, of distance. In other words, not merely as a mind picture, a picture, but as living, vibrating realities. Now, if fortunately enough the organism can remain perfectly poised, and the awareness easily contain all this, the sun, the earth, and oneself. What is really the silence takes effect in you. You can, I'm going to use a strange phrase, you can hear the silence.